Welcome to the China MENA podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. The Belt and Road Initiative has become ubiquitous in international affairs, but when it was rolled out in 2013, very few people outside China paid attention. It wasn't until 2015, when the Chinese government published a white paper on the BRI, that the implications started to become more clear to the wider world. In 2021 and 2022, China introduced two other initiatives, the Global Development Initiative, or the GDI, and the Global Security Initiative, or GSI. Earlier this year, a third was unveiled, the Global Civilization Initiative. And so far, the international response has followed the same pattern with the BRI, relative silence. To discuss the GSI and GDI and their broader international implications, I'm delighted to be joined by my two co-authors of a recent Atlanta Council issue brief, How Beijing's Newest Global Initiatives Seek to Remake the World Order. Michael Schumann and Tuvi Gehring are both non-resident senior fellows with the Atlanta Council's Global China Hub. Michael is a journalist who's been reporting from Asia for over 25 years and the author, most recently, of Superpower Interrupted, The Chinese History of the World. Tuvia is a researcher at the Dayan and Guilford Glaser Foundation Israel-China Policy Center at INSS in Israel and author of the excellent Discourse Power on Substack. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, great to have you both here. So Tuvia, can you get us started? Can you please tell us what are the GSI and GDI and what are they meant to accomplish?
Yeah, so I think we need to take a step back and understand the context of China's thinking about these new initiatives. So Xi Jinping believes that the world is undergoing great changes unseen in a century. And all exegesis in China, they'll add that the East is rising and the West is declining. That's what it means. Beyond propaganda, if you look at the economic data, there is some substance to it. Look at the IMF report recently that said that 70% of world growth is responsible for Asia. Asia is responsible, right? And the global economic and population demographic center of gravity is shifting eastward, with China being at the center. And China believes that it's not enough to just govern itself because it's fifth of humanity. And as COVID showed us, China's whatever happens in China can affect the world and vice versa. And because of that, because their fates are intertwined, this also means that the Chinese dream of Xi Jinping is intertwined with the global dreams of everyone else. And there is a problem in all that story, is global governance used to be controlled by the US-led Western hegemony since the end of the Cold War. But they've been failing miserably in their job. And someone else needs to step up and take control and reform global governance to democratize it, to make it more multipolar and fair and just. And China is able to do that role. And if everything goes right, the three new initiatives, the GDI, GSI, GCI, together with the Belt and Road Initiative, they will create a future where you will see both the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, as well as realization of Xi Jinping's vision of creating a community with a shared destiny for mankind. So that's just the idea. What it actually means, the GDI development officially means to expedite the realization of the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, there are 17 of them. The GSI security is introducing a new security concept, a new way of thinking about global security. It has what they call six commitments. The most important of which I think is indivisible security. Again, the same idea. My fate is intertwined with yours. Also, the UN Charter is important, and there's no group that is more important than others. And merging between traditional and non-traditional security concerns like biosecurity and terrorism and so on. As for the GCI, that's the most recent one in March. So it's important where he unveiled it. It was during the high-level dialogue between political parties, between the Chinese Communist Party and other global parties. And it advocates the four shared proposal, or the Sige Gongtong Changdao, which calls for diversity of civilizations, the common values of all mankind, not common, not universal, we can talk about that, the importance of civilizational heritage and innovation, and finally, international exchanges, cooperation in humanities, in the humanities. And that's about it. But beyond all this propaganda, and I think we'll talk about this in more detail, all of these new initiatives have strong anti-Western, post-Western wish from China to create this new world order that the U.S. plays a much less significant role. So that's the basics, I think.
Okay, thank you. That's a good overview. So Michael, turning to you, two of you kind of touched on it, but just to give a little more detail, why did Beijing feel the need to roll out these initiatives? What gap was there in the international system that China thought it had the job to fill?
Well, I think from Beijing's perspective, the current, you know, U.S.-led world order, what the U.S. likes to call the rules-based world order, is kind of a hostile place, right? This is a world system that's based on liberal values and universal values, and those have been defined by the United States and its democratic partners, and that's created a world system that has elevated democracy to the only form of government that actually has legitimacy. So if you're sitting in Beijing and you're in a kind of a proud authoritarian state, you're looking around the world, you're getting more powerful. And I think the leaders in Beijing have come to realize that they need to alter this world order. They need to gain more influence within it. They need to reshape it and make it a place that, from their perspective, is less hostile to their ideas, to their growing power, and to promote a different ideological foundation to the way countries interact, to the way governments see each other, and also a different foundation of ideals behind the world system to make it a place that's basically friendlier to autocracy. And as Tuvia said, these initiatives that Beijing has put out, you know, they don't directly mention the United States per se, but there is a very, very clear element within them that these are directed against the United States, directed against the West, and directed against the ideas about democracy and human rights that the U.S. and its allies have been pushing for decades, and in many ways have been quite successful at it. So what I think these initiatives are important parts of that effort to try to change the way global governance works, to try to change the way people think about how global governance should work and what ideas and values should and should not be behind that system.
If
that's
I can
great. Thanks, Michael.
Jump in, Jonathan. There's one example just to show what Michael just described. When Xi Jinping unveiled the GCI, he said at the beginning, the Chinese model is a proof that modernization is not equal to westernization. And then the president and party secretary of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Gao Xiang, he wrote about this, a long piece translated by China Interpret. And he says the GCI is quintessentially China showing that the capitalist model has failed and we have a superior model, which is a new form of human civilization created by the CCP and the public good for the greater of humanity.
Stuvia. You know, Michael, when you were talking about the contrast, I kept thinking about the timing of when these were unveiled. You know, if you think back to 2021 and early 22, the world looked a little different than it does today.
Right.
You know, in 21, you know, there was this very common narrative around a lot of the global South, a lot of authoritarian countries,
right,
that you know, the democracy didn't solve COVID properly. The response didn't work. There's all this division within these countries. The West is fragmented, and China looked like it was on top of things.
Right.
And you see the GDI is introduced, and it seems like China's got answers for everybody. And then the GSI was rolled out just a few weeks after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Right. Again, with this idea that the West was fragmented, NATO wasn't going to be unified anymore. I wonder if they would roll out those two things the same way if they had a do-over. Because right now, I think it doesn't look as efficient as it did.
Well, yes, the world has changed quite a bit. I mean, look, part of this is, as Tuvia mentioned, a big part of the motivation behind these initiatives is the idea that I think was, and I think to a great degree still is, widely held in Beijing, that the U.S. is in inexorable and inevitable decline, and this is basically China's moment to rise to the top of the world order. But recently, I think, kind of reading the tea leaves, I think the leaders in Beijing have been somewhat taken aback by kind of the resilience and resurgence in the United States in the post-COVID period, both within the United States itself, with the economic recovery, with the success that the Biden administration has had, but also in terms of the resurgence of America's global standing under the Biden administration, the way that it's been able to revitalize its alliances and to get greater coordination and cooperation among the allies and other partners, and to a great degree in regard to issues relating to China. But what's happened because of that is, rather than backing off, I think what you see is Beijing somewhat doubling down on these initiatives, and as you know, as Tuvia mentioned, even mentioning a new one in March in this very, very new kind of global political environment. So I think rather than rethinking what they're doing, I feel that they almost need to kind of slam on the gas pedal to try to push some of these ideas and initiatives even harder than they were before, to keep what they see, I think, the momentum going in their favor.
Right. So Tuvia, I want to come back to you. I mean, when I think of the way these have been introduced, it reminds me a lot of the Belt and Road in 2013. We heard a lot of platitudes. We heard a lot of speeches. People talked about the Belt and the One Belt, One Road was in everybody's speech, but nobody really knew what it was. There wasn't a lot of substance. And then you saw this period of about maybe 20 months when all of the ministries had to kind of catch up to the platitudes and kind of figure out how they're going to incorporate the Belt and Road into their various charges. Do you think it'll be similar with the GSI and GDR? Are we going to see them start to put some meat on the bones? And if so, what shape do you expect they're going to take over the next couple of years?
Yeah, certainly. There's a lot of similarities here. And all the cynics will come and say, you know, this is just China being China, giving all these slogans. And then anyone who wants to promote his own initiative, he just slaps the name of the slogan into his own brand. And there you go. You have the blessing of Xi Jinping. So give me funding from state-owned banks and so on. But the Chinese analysts will tell you that this is just the way Chinese roll under the Chinese Communist Party. They give up the general directive up top, and then bottom up, they build the what you call the meat on the bones, and we will see this fleshed out. And remember, the Belt and Road Initiative, now it's a household name. These two, they are promoted in each and every single interaction that China now has with foreign actors, whether bilateral or multilateral. So we will hear a lot more about them and what they mean in essence. So we saw a bit of progress on the GDI. So last year, during a dialogue, Xi Jinping unveiled 32 deliverables, they call it. These are basically action plans of policy targets, I guess. A few weeks ago, they released progress support, like a 32 pages. And there you can see they divide the different 32 deliverables into these categories. And I give you one category and a few examples just to get an idea what it means to flesh it out. So on platform building, that's one. So they build an NGO network, which is ironic since NGOs are illegal in China, but whatever. A global development center, also probably based in China. A global vaccine center. There is one. There's a couple, actually, the UN, but the People's Republic of Redundancy here. Partnerships, Chinese-led conferences for agriculture, for data, for youth development. Funding support, that's another one. For example, the South-South Cooperation Fund that's had existed long before the last decade, so they added another $1 billion for it. We need to follow how much and how this money is spent. Capacity building, this I think is important because we do see some progress on that. For example, in Luban workshops, sorry, this is a new program that a really good Washington report came out last week, I think, about these Luban workshops. Basically, this means vocational training made by China in China for Chinese products and Chinese technologies. They're planning on training 20,000 people in this year, the next few years, and 100,000 eventually by the end of the decade or something like that. And then you have knowledge sharing, which is also interesting. They provide satellite sharing and data sharing plan, again, with China at the center. And on security, we saw some progress in March when the China was able to mediate between Iran and Saudi Arabia, right? So they came and said, look, this is a model example of the success of the GSI, but we all know this is not really the case. This is something that had existed prior and was mediated by Iraq, Oman, and the US even. However, what we will see is more and much more of the same, and we might see an inflection point. So one thing we're going to see China being taken more seriously as a mediator in conflicts. We will see more Chinese weapons in the Middle East, for example. In the last decades, it's 80% increase versus 30% decrease for the U.S., according to Kurila, the commander of CENTCOM. And we'll see more military diplomacy, which China was already pretty active there, and perhaps more bases. That's also very likely. Finally, with civilization, and here I end, we will see more people-to-people ties. Again, these are things that existed. This is just slapping a new brand to it. But you'll see more of the same. For example, last week, there was a fourth dialogue between China and Arab countries, and Liu Jianchao said that they're going to invite every single year 200 Arab political leaders to China, in addition to a dozen other programs that they plan on holding. So they will flesh these out. We need to pay attention. They will develop.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to come back to the Middle East in a second, but Michael, I just want to look more broadly at the international scene. You know, Tuvi kept saying for China, by China, in China. This seems a very China-centered set of initiatives. Beyond the domestic audience, who's the target for these? I mean, they clearly represent an alternative to these Western preferred norms and institutions. Do you think there's an appetite for these projects in the rest of the world beyond the West?
Well, I think a lot of the messaging surrounding the GSI and the GDI, especially the GDI, are directed at the global South. I think that the leaders in Beijing, I'm not going to say that they've written off the West as in the sense that they won't have any dialogue with the U.S. and Europe and their partners entirely, but I think they've come to see the U.S. and its allies as somewhat implacably hostile. So I think the direction of Chinese foreign policy overall is being shifted towards the global South. Its economic energies are being redirected there. And a lot of the messaging of the GS and GDI, as you said, because it has a bit of an anti-Western tone to it. The idea is to present China as an alternative to the U.S., as an alternative to the U.S. system, and an alternative to the ideas that the U.S. has been pushing on the world. And I think there is an audience for this, especially obviously other authoritarian states around the world will find some of these ideas very appealing. But I also think in a situation that where you have, you know, since the end of the Cold War, you basically had one global superpower. I think many countries and many governments are looking for alternatives to this, and China is presenting itself in that way. I don't necessarily think that that means the global South will automatically kind of flock to China's banner, but I do think it means that governments and leaders in the global South will kind of be happy to have, you know, more than one option in terms of where they get their development finance, who they're going to partner with economically, what political programs they may want to engage in. And a lot of the countries in the global South want to be better represented in international institutions and international forums. And this may be a way of achieving, China may be a way of achieving that. So, I think there is an audience out there. I mean, we could talk about this more. I mean, I think there's also some serious hurdles and issues that China will face in really gaining adherence to these initiatives in a way. The amount of kind of buy-in that China will need be from the rest of the world to back these initiatives in a way that they really influence global governance, that's another story. But there is at least an appetite for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I think the idea that China appeals to this mass block of countries in the global South, you know, and that they want what China has to offer, I think is really overstating the, like, not that that wasn't your point. Your point was the opposite, and I agree completely. It's not that they want what China has to offer. They just want options, right? They want alternatives. I don't
think China's done a tremendously good job of presenting itself as an alternative. I mean, that was a whole idea behind Belt and Road Initiative, right? Which was like, you know, the poorer nations of the world need more financing, need more development. The existing institutions of the world order aren't providing it in the way that developing countries need and want. So China is going to present an alternative development program that's financed in alternative ways and done in alternative ways. That has been not necessarily. I mean, we keep coming back to the BRI as a model for where the GSI and GDI may be going, but the BRI also, I think, presents some kind of warning signals to China. You know, the BRI has hardly been an unmitigated success. And, you know, the Chinese themselves are in the process of rethinking the BRI and how they want to engage in development programs and finance for the future. Their development lending from their main state banks has plunged dramatically in recent years. China, by proposing these programs, by putting a lot of money and effort behind them, doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to automatically be successful and they're going to bring the benefits that they're supposed to bring. And then, of course, that undermines China's greater effort to build influence for itself and to influence the direction of global governance.
Yeah, I think the message for the U.S. and its allies and partners is it's just a more competitive playing field. So you've got to step up your game in a lot of these countries because they're not naturally drawn to China. It's just a more competitive playing field.
Right.
Tuvia, I want to come back to a couple of points you're making about the Middle East. I mean, Middle East, North Africa, there's clearly a lot of justifiable frustration with the U.S. in particular and the West in general in their approach to the region. There's this narrative that is it can't be shaken, that the U.S. wants to leave, that the West is constantly lecturing them about liberal values and democratic values and trying to force them into a direction that a lot of these countries aren't comfortable with. And then China comes in and says, we have a different way of doing things. Are these initiatives gaining traction in the Middle East, North Africa? You know, for Middle Eastern audiences, do they represent an attractive alternative, do you think?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things to pick here. I think I totally agree that these ideas are resonated here a lot. It's no secret that the U.S. has, you know, lost popularity in the region, and the West in general suffering from hubris and hypocrisy and narcissism even. And of course, they carry a historical luggage of colonialism, and that doesn't give them extra credit. And, you know, the rules-based international order for many people here died in Iraq with a couple of 100,000 Iraqis. And when you look at the World Trade Organization, the U.S. has been also violating many of the rules. And if you look a few years back and perhaps into the future, God forbid, when we get Trump again, it was the U.S., the isolationist and, you know, not a, a very multipolar player or a global player on that front. So that was a big own goal. And then China steps in and says, we have alternatives. We have something better. We have a new form of human civilization. We have a new development model. And I think that for anyone going to China, especially if you visited 10 years ago and then visit again, and you see the progress, you see the skyscrapers, as the cliche goes, China has achieved pretty tremendous growth. It's still, you know, albeit a developing country with many people still impoverished, but its growth model is attractive. If not wholesale, then at least parts of it, and they think they can learn from it. That's one thing. And another thing which Michael talked about is the authoritarian appeal. So the elites listen to Xi and he tells them, look, I have a better model and the Chinese model proves you don't have to modernize, to westernize if you want to modernize. Just be like us. And not only that, we're not exporting our model. Don't even go that way. But we do this, you know, DIY authoritarianism. We give you all these packages of techno-authoritarianism tools, and, you know, just use them and control populations like they do in Iran, for example. So the elite, they find these ideas pretty appealing. And now for traction, that's a different story. So the GSI security, I think, is a bit harder because development, it's pretty hard to say no to development, right? That's something one of Chinese diplomats we quote in our piece says, like, who could say no to development, right? And that's part of the kind of sugarcoating of these illiberal ideas is development, right? But security here, it becomes a bit more contentious. So they released a GSI concept paper, which for the Middle East, it calls for creating a new security architecture for the region. I published a paper about this for the Atlantic Council before the mediation happened in March. And it calls for creating a larger, more authoritative, more influential international peace conference. We know that China wants to hold a security dialogue here in the Gulf between Iran and the Gulf monarchies. And of course, needless to say, none of these new frameworks include the U.S. or Israel, for that matter, as we speak at least. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that's a different story, but also part of the architecture. So when you look at the GSI that happened in March, I went around and asked some Israeli officials. So if you recall, Chingan, who's now Chingan, unfortunately, missing in action. So he talked with our foreign minister, Eli Cohen, and he told them, have you heard the good news? We have a GSI. We're going to mediate between you and the Palestinians. And that was in April. So the next month I called different officials and we also got a chance to talk with them here at the INSS. And, you know, when I asked them, what do you think of Chingang's GSI? And it was like, who's Chingang and what the hell is a GSI? So I think that's kind of the approach you're going to hear from people that are not involved in China research in the region. It's more a branding thing. It will catch on eventually, but still, when it comes to security, the U.S. is the main security provider. There's no question about it, and regional countries say so themselves. As for civilization, I think this is the most pernicious one if you sit in more liberal countries, because this undermines directly universal values. This undermines rationality, it undermines humanity, and it undermines universal values that are universal. They're not Western. They were even conceived with China, a Chinese delegate. Before they proposed the GCI, they used to say that we were part of making universal values, but all of a sudden we have common values. And these common values of development, security, fairness, justice, and let's see what are the two others, democracy and freedom, right? This is, you know, this is just making a joke out of these things that are so important for humanity. And these are the illiberal values. So unfortunately, if you're not sitting in Israel, in many countries here, either you're an elite and you think that these ideas sound kind of swell because you do see more authoritarian means of control, or you live in a poor country and you think that human rights are not the most important thing right now. You want development and you want more control, because if you look, for example, at our neighbor, Lebanon, or you look even at Jordan, right, doing fares much better. You know what? They'd much rather live under authoritarian control, but be as rich as the Saudis or the Emiratis, you know? And when you mix all these things together and you just wrap them in a nice gift wrap and promote them here, I think they will gain traction. And they repeat this all the time. So even European leaders, like the Czech president, if I recall, he already praised the GCI. For the GDI, we have Antonio Guterres from the UN, who praises it. And there are 70 countries that joined the group of friends of the GDI that is headquartered in New York, right? And this will survive the SDGs 2030. So after 2030, you're going to have China-centric development for the world. And for the GSI, we will have more frameworks. That's what they're saying, including here in the region. And little by little, they will gain traction. Absolutely. Because China wants them to gain traction, and they're investing the resources to do so. And there is a chance, as Michael said before, that many of these things could backfire, like they did for the BRI. Again, this is not to say the BRI failed. I don't think it failed. I think it succeeded in many aspects. It tried. If you look at statistics of growth in BRI countries, so that's not necessarily a failure, and there's no such thing as a debt trap. That was completely disproved. However, there are real problems that these initiatives cause. And this gave China perhaps less appetite to overstretch. And if you look at the GDI, for example, just to give you an idea how just the example, okay, for Jordan, right? There's a big report by ABC about this Atarat power plant. And right now, it's just a white elephant. And people in Jordan now took China to court, international court. And this, just one example from the region, there's a dozen others from Africa, you know, Kenya and Sudan, I think, that need to restructure their debt, and Ghana too. And in Asia, got Sri Lanka and so on. For the GSI, they talk about the UN Charter, right? This is part of the six commitments. So let's see what the Chinese approach with the GSI, how much did they help a single Ukrainian right now in the war for the most flagrant violation of the UN Charter and its values. And take the same thing for Iran and what it does here, which continues to proliferate, continues to spread extremism and terrorism. And their best buddies was China. The President Raisi becomes a professor, honorary professor of Peking University, where many of these ideas came from, right? The liberal university of Daejeon. And I think we will see more challenges, and we will see challenge even more from the West and from the rest of the world, and from just facts on the ground and people here that see what the high-sounding rhetoric, and then compare it to actual reality. So these are all things to watch closely, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot in there to think about. One thing though that you mentioned is just the attraction among elites. And then you wrapped up by talking about Raisi's trip when he was, you know, feted at Peking University and given the honorary doctorate. And they gave a speech, I believe, praising him for his contributions to security and peace and freedom around the region. And I keep thinking about the gap between elites and the publics. You know, sure, there's a lot of authoritarian governments in the region, but the people aren't necessarily happy with that. We've seen over the past, you know, decade plus, you know, this constant pushback against these authoritarian governments. And it kind of reminds me of when, you know, the last official to visit the Shah you know, was Hua Guofeng, right? The Chinese president at the time who stopped in Iran on his way back home. And the people in Iran were outraged. You visit who we saw as an illegitimate leader at a time when people are dying in the streets and we can't take it anymore. And you give him legitimacy and give him a little boost. And I kept thinking about that when Raisi went to Beijing and thinking, okay, government to government, this is supporting a lot of what both of them want. But the people of Iran have to look at this and are really upset. And I think that's probably something China's got to watch out for with promoting some of this stuff with kind of, you know, heavy-handed governments around the region. There's a big gap between what states want and what their people want. And I think that's something that we've got to think about going forward. But I guess that leads to a question I want to ask you, Michael, just kind of looking beyond the Middle East is, you know, what does this mean for existing norms and practices around the world? You know, like how should status quo countries that like the so-called rules-based or liberal international order or unipolarity or whatever we want to call it, you know, countries that you know, enjoy the benefits of this system, how should they respond to this challenge from China?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you raise a really interesting point, is that, you know, in some ways, the U.S.-led global order has been tremendously successful. And in one of those ways has been elevating the idea of democracy. And when you look at polls around the world and even within the global South, you'll see extremely high rates of support for democracy in many parts of the world, like including Africa and Latin America. So among the public, these ideas are still very appealing. And here you have China coming in with an alternative set of ideas. But that gets into the problems they're facing, especially, I think, with the GSI, is, you know, you're getting into the realm of ideas and ideologies. The BRI was about development and money, and countries need money, and the Chinese were dishing out money. So it was always going to get a certain amount of support. Now that the Chinese are going into the realm of ideas, they actually have to market their ideas as superior to the ones that are currently existing in the world order. And that's a very, very different task, not only because of public attitudes, but look, to a certain extent, China is becoming guilty of what they accused the U.S. of doing, which is pushing their ideas onto everybody else. As Tuvia mentioned, there's no diplomatic interaction that China engages in these days, where they don't trot out these initiatives expecting whoever's on the other side of the table to endorse or at least say nice things about them. So while the U.S. has been pushing a set of liberal economic and political ideas, now the Chinese find themselves in the position of pushing an illiberal set of political ideas in not all that different a way. And the question is, how are other governments and people around the world going to respond to this? As you said, there's always going to be elites, especially in authoritarian companies, who see this as a way of probably solidifying their control. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be popular on a wide scale. And also, as China grows in power and grows in influence around the world, they're going to run into problems with some of these ideas. The more active they become in global diplomacy, Tuvia was just mentioning the contradictions between their ideas and actions on Ukraine. They open themselves up to this kind of criticism that they're not following through on their own. They don't practice what they preach, so to speak. And also, as they gain in power, their relationship with other countries is changing, especially within the global South, and that's changing the relationship between China and other developing countries. When you look at again the effect of BRI. Has been to turn China into the major creditor for a lot of developing countries. And that's changing the dynamic in their relationship. So there's all of these factors going on that I think is going to make the GSI and GDI and some of these ideas a harder sell than they may appear at first glance.
It's a great point. I mean, I think there seems to be an inevitability in the way a lot of people talk about this stuff. And, you know, for every a reaction, there's a reaction in global politics, right? It's not like China gets to do this stuff uncontested and everybody's just going to accept it. There's going to be a lot of pushback. And I think that it's funny, the way I see it, especially in the Middle East, is it's often being described as like a chess game where, you know, China supplies COVID, you know, vaccines, and they say check. And then the U.S. brings in the Abraham Accords and they say check, and everybody's waiting for checkmate. The way I see it is just watching two really good tennis players hitting the ball back and forth at each other, and it's just going to keep going until one of them, there's an unforced error, or somebody comes up with a, you know, there's going to be a lot of hitting it back and forth on this, I think.
I'm sorry.
No, please.
No, I'm sorry. I thought you were closing. Look, I think what we've seen around the world is most countries really don't want to be on one side of the court or the other side of the court. I mean, there's always going to be some clear allies of the United States and clear partners of China. But I don't think they represent most of the world. I think most of the world is kind of happy to sit on the net and see what falls their way and to take what they think is best for their own interests, their own development, their own political development from one side or the other side. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think we tend to see superpower competition as inherently negative, and in many ways, of course, it is. It potentially leads to conflict. It's bad for global prosperity. But at the same time, for a lot of countries around the world who are looking for more attention, looking for more development finance, looking to have a larger voice in what happens in world affairs, this competition between the U.S. and China isn't necessarily a bad thing. And you can see that as how Washington and the Europeans have come back with their own alternatives to the Belt and Road Program, increasing their own development finance. So I think it's not at all clear how these issues are going to play out. I don't think it's going to be kind of a clear one-on-one contest. And I think you're going to see the world divide up in different ways on different issues at different times, depending on circumstances and their own interests.
Yep.
Saudi foreign minister Faisal bin Farhan said in last month, I think, that we don't subscribe to this zero-sum game. And I think we're all capable of having multiple partnerships and multiple engagements. And the U.S. Will, you know, it does the same. So just to reiterate what Michael said, I think instead of thinking of it as a tennis match between two powers, you can think there's a huge gymnasium and you got the two old guys playing tennis, and people want, they can join them the game, or they have their own court and they have a swimming pool too for the kiddies. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. As Michael said, this is the upside of multilateralism, that we may have more powers help balancing the two, well, at least for the region, two now offshore balancers instead of one dominating hegemon.
Guys, thanks so much. I could go on about this all day with you, but we've all got stuff to do and we're all in different time zones. So I'm going to put links to our report, or our issue brief rather, on the homepage. I'll put links to your book, Michael, to your great Substack, Tuvia. All great stuff, and look forward to more great work from both of you coming up soon. To our listeners, thank you for joining us. Follow us on social media, subscribe, review, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Produced by Heartcast Media.